Welcome to this month's special guest interview.
This month, I'm very pleased to have Dr. Aubrey de Grey as my special expert guest. Dr. Aubrey de Grey is a biomedical gerontologist based in Cambridge, UK, and Mountain View, California. He received his BA and PhD from the University of Cambridge in 1985 and 2000, respectively. Dr. de Grey is the Chief Science Officer of SENS Research Foundation and Editor-in-Chief of Rejuvenation Research, the world's highest impact peer-reviewed journal focused on intervention in aging. Dr. de Grey's research interests encompass the characterization of all the accumulating and eventually pathogenic molecular and cellular side effects of metabolism that constitute mammalian aging and the design of interventions to repair and or obviate them. His comprehensive plan for such repair, termed Strategies for Engineered Negligible Senescence, or SENS, breaks aging down into seven major classes of damage and identifies detailed approaches to addressing each one. Good evening, Dr. de Grey, and welcome to this month's edition of Sports Nutrition Update.
Good evening. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
It's wonderful to have you on, and I know that you're in Europe right now. And what is the flavor or the climate of intellectualism over there, and how's it been so far on your tour?
Well, I do a lot of traveling. I speak all over the world all the time. There's not all that much difference between different places, to be perfectly honest, not in respect of my work anyway.
So I think that our students would like to know what motivates you to do what you do. And I know that you have a background in computer science. So I know that you switched from computer science to biogerontology. Why did you do that?
Well, the main reason that I switched from computer science to working on the biology of aging was because I discovered in my late 20s that hardly any biologists were taking the biology of aging particularly seriously. Almost all biologists felt that aging was not a particularly interesting phenomenon. It was not something which could be studied productively, and it was not something that was really their business. And this was completely contrary to what I had always assumed. So when I discovered this, I thought, well, okay, I'm currently working in computer science in artificial intelligence research, which has great humanitarian potential for alleviating all the problem of people having to do stuff all day that they wouldn't do if they weren't paid. But that's actually only the world's second most important problem. The world's most important problem is the fact that we get sick and die at a relatively predictable and rather early age. And we ought to fix that, really. So I decided to switch.
Have you been personally affected by someone in your life that you love or care about who has suffered terribly from these diseases of aging?
Actually, I've been relatively lucky in that regard. I lost my mother 5 years ago. She was 86. But she actually, by the standards of most people, was relatively little afflicted. She had a relatively rapid decline. She never had any sign of dementia. So, you know, all in all, no. I've not been driven by the people around me, per se. It's been a much more general humanitarian motivation.
What about biogerontology? What exactly does that word mean?
Okay, so it's a good question because it's worth going into a little detail there. Biogerontology normally is used to describe the study of the phenomenon of aging in living organisms, as in the same way that, you know, cosmology might be the study of the universe. And that's distinct from clinical gerontology, which is geriatric medicine, basically, the study of how to use medical treatments that we already have today to alleviate as best we can the suffering and ill health that the elderly encounter. Actually, when people ask me to locate myself in the universe of different types of gerontologists, I don't call myself either of those things. I call myself a biomedical gerontologist. So that's kind of midway between a biogerontologist and a clinical gerontologist. I work not on the biology of aging for the purpose of just understanding it better. I'm definitely interested in doing something about it. But on the other hand, I'm also interested not just in applying medicines that already exist, but in developing new medicines that work much better than medicines that exist so far.
I know that in many of your talks, you've made a specific effort to define what the word aging means, because I assume that you think that most people don't use it correctly in social settings. Can you give us your definition of aging?
Sure. I wouldn't exactly say that most people's definitions are incorrect. It's just that very often the definitions that people use are not useful. They don't actually help people to understand how we might go about postponing the ill health of old age. So the definition that I use says simply that aging is the accumulation of damage in the body, damage that is created as a kind of side effect of being alive in the first place and of the normal metabolism, the normal metabolic processes that the body performs from day to day, even starting before we're born. So in that sense, aging is not really a phenomenon of biology. I prefer to describe it as a phenomenon of physics, because inanimate objects like cars have aging the same as we do. Effectively, what we can say is that any machine that has moving parts is going to damage itself as a side effect of its normal operation. And, you know, that's just how it is. And so the human body is no different. And that, I think, is a useful definition because not only does it actually explain what aging is, it also, if you like, demystifies it. It makes it clear that we don't have this problem of lack of comprehension. We do understand aging.
When you say physics, are you talking about gravity, oxidation, radiation, and entropy?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, of course, one doesn't need to understand them in fine detail. We all understand what aging of a car is. You know, you get rust, you get, you know, the oil and it gets contaminated and so on. And we also, of course, understand how to counteract the aging of a car. We understand how to do maintenance on it, periodic preventative maintenance. And we understand furthermore that the more comprehensive we do that maintenance, the more comprehensively, the more effective it is. That's why we have vintage cars that are 100 years old. Those cars were not designed to last 100 years. They were only designed to last maybe 10 years. But the application of really comprehensive preventative maintenance actually works.
So in my experience, I'm 59 and I have seen people develop a fear of death that's associated with aging, and I have seen them handle what I seem to have always thought of as being absolute, you know, like that's one of the absolutes in life, taxes and aging, as they say, right, or death. So Why is it that so many people, if this is such a common thing and everyone dies, or at least they've always seemed to have died, why is it that people, and maybe this is tied into your movement or maybe a lack of massive involvement in the movement, why is it that people can't seem to deal with death in their own children or spouse or grandparents and as a reality of life?
I think it's a psychological thing. The point is, you see, aging of a car doesn't matter very much. You can always go and buy a new one. People don't mourn their cars. Whereas in the case of aging of the human body, it's much more scary. And of course, because the human body is so much more complicated than any man-made machine, we haven't actually got very far yet in developing this comprehensive preventative maintenance. Of course, my organization, Sense Research Foundation, is spearheading the effort to change that, but we still have a long way to go. So people are very apprehensive about getting their hopes up. And in a way, they prefer to just carry on thinking in terms of aging as this inevitable thing, so as to, if you like, put it out of their minds and continue to make their peace with it. I think that's basically cowardly, but, you know, it's a natural reaction. And so I think it's not surprising. I've never been surprised by the resistance that I've encountered, the irrational resistance that I've encountered.
That's wonderful. I agree. And I kind of developed an attitude of what I would say Spock would have. It's just based on logic and reason and rationality as something that happens and I try and understand it. And of course, I have emotions and I try and control those. Now, the purpose and direction of SENS, S-E-N-S, can you talk about that, please?
Okay, so first of all, let me distinguish carefully between two uses of that term. Sense, as we like to use it, is simply the concept of how we think we can actually really bring aging under medical control. It's an idea that I first started to think about and promote about 15 years ago now, and it's all about doing this periodic damage repair, preventative maintenance, as I like to call it, as opposed to what used to be the traditional way of thinking about combating aging, which was the cleaning up of our metabolism, so to speak, so that the damage would be created at a slower rate in the first place. That concept is still very prominent in the study of the biology of aging, but it's not looking very promising, because in order to actually implement that, you have to understand how the body works really well, whereas damage repair kind of sidesteps our ignorance in that regard. So that's one use of the term. The other use is the organization, and that may be what you were asking about. So the organization that's been created around my work, the public charity based in California that we have, that sometimes people call that SENSE as well, but that's an abbreviation. The real name is SENSE Research Foundation.
I see. Now, I'm familiar with Denman Harmon and his published work on oxidative damage and free radicals, and then the Hayflick limit and various ideas or theories on aging. Do you lend yourself to any of those theories? Do you deny them, or do you want to expand on them or add to them? What is your idea of how we're aging, and what is your understanding of that?
Well, Denham Harmon's idea, the free radical theory of aging, is undoubtedly valid. In other words, the mechanism that he proposed, that aging was substantially driven by the creation of free radicals in the body and the damage that those free radicals would inflict, that is undoubtedly the case. Of course, one can always, for any theory of aging, one can always state it in a weak form and a strong form, the weak form being that the mechanism in question makes a substantial contribution to the creation of damage, and the strong form being that it makes the dominant contribution, that it kind of, you know, overwhelms everything else. And I think we can safely say at this point in our understanding of aging that the weak form of lots of theories of aging is true, and the strong form of no theories of aging is true, because there are a lot of different things that contribute to the creation of damage. You mentioned Len Hayflick's discovery of the finite ability of cells to divide. This is something that is still somewhat controversial in terms of the magnitude of its contribution to aging in mammals and in humans. Some people think that it's quite important because there are a lot of functions that rely on cell division. And some people say, well, actually, no, the functions that rely on a lot of cell division tend to avoid the Hayflick limit because the cells in question actually make small amounts of an enzyme called telomerase that essentially eliminates the Hayflick limit. However, the truth may very well be somewhere in between, especially if the immune system appears to be quite susceptible to the Hayflick limit.
What about this hydrozoan? I think it's a jellyfish. It's in the sea. I'm sure you're well aware of it. It's Turritopsis neutrocula. Apparently, it's immortal, because I've done some investigation about how long animals live, like a tortoise or a koi fish or a sturgeon. And, you know, we look at the different lifespans. Is that something that interests you as to why it's able to regenerate itself? And apparently it has no limited lifespan?
So it's interesting, but from a medical point of view, it's not very interesting, to be perfectly honest. The thing about this jellyfish and a number of other species, primitive species, that appear to have no aging at all, is that they achieve that lack of aging by having a very different body composition than what we do. And in particular, one thing they definitely don't have is a self-respecting brain, you know, a brain worthy of the name. That's a bit of a sacrifice, really. And this is very closely linked to why they don't age. What happens in species like this is that, whether all the time or perhaps only periodically, but quite often, all of their cells divide. And that's very important. Cell division is an extremely powerful rejuvenating process. It dilutes away damage, it selects away damage, and it's a pretty reasonable thing to say that advanced animals, higher animals, have essentially sold their soul to aging by developing organs, especially the brain, whose function relies on their being made from cells that sit around not dividing for a long, long, long time.
So you're saying that the cost to us is the limitation. Now, what about colleagues in your field who disagree with you? What is the main position stand they take, saying that it's impossible to prolong human life indefinitely, or say for 1,000 or 500 years? What do they usually use as their position stand?
Well, the first thing I should probably point out is that there's a lot less dissent from my position now than there was maybe 10 years ago. When I first started talking about all this, as I mentioned earlier, the idea that I put forward, the idea of sense, was quite a departure from what people had been thinking before in terms of cleaning up metabolism and slowing down the creation of damage. And for that reason, it took quite a while for a lot of my colleagues to really understand what I was saying well enough to be able to understand whether it was valid. But over the years, that's changed. Obviously, people have become more knowledgeable, more comprehending of what I'm saying. And at this point, there's very little opposition. I mean, there are people who are concerned about what my proposals imply in terms of the magnitude of how long we might live, and a certain amount of, shall we say, avoidance of real debate on that matter. But in terms of the feasibility of the specific approaches that we are pursuing, the argument is pretty much over. In fact, we've now got to the point where people are even, you know, mainstream gerontologists are even reinventing these ideas and pretending that they're new. So it's, you know, it's a case of there's no end to what somebody can get done if he doesn't mind not getting the credit. But, you know, that's fine by me. As far as I'm concerned, what matters is that these ideas have now become orthodox. The reason that's happened, of course, is that, to answer your original question, the arguments that were put forward early on were just not very good. They were based on essentially not understanding what I was saying in the first place, or on ignorance of the work that had already been done on which I was basing these ideas. And that's why these criticisms have more or less gone away.
Excellent. Now, this next question is kind of a lead-in to the next one coming, and that is, I had a teacher and mentor, Dr. Michael Colgan. He always used to say, Corey, none of us dies of disease. We all die of damage. In essence, do you agree with that statement?
Insofar as I understand what he was getting at, yes, I do agree with it. I think that it is a big mistake, and indeed an extremely counterproductive and damaging mistake, to view the specific diseases of old age, like Alzheimer's or atherosclerosis or whatever, as in some way distinct from some phenomenon called aging itself. That's really problematic, because what it does is it gives people the impression that one might be able to cure the diseases of old age in the same way that one can cure infections, which is complete nonsense, because the diseases of old age are side effects of being alive, same as the things that we call aging itself. So really the right way to think of aging is as some kind of, not a disease, but rather as a kind of uber disease that incorporates and encompasses all of the specific aspects of ill health in old age, the ones that we call diseases and the ones that we don't.
So this leads into this question now. That was a great answer, by the way. And that is, you've got seven major classes of damage. So if we're dying of damage or suffering because of damage, you've obviously spent a lot of time researching what that damage is, and you've theorized or come up with practical solutions or theoretical solutions on how to solve them, to solve this puzzle. So what are the significant seven major classes, and maybe in simple terms, what can we do ourselves rather than waiting for the fancy drugs or the interventions of the future? What can we do today to stave off some of this damage, in your opinion?
Well, the seven types of damage, you know, I've written and spoken about them many, many times, so it would probably not be a good use of my time to go through the details of what they are and how to fix them. But let's suffice to say that these are seven categories, each of which covers a lot of different individual examples within aging, and that classification has stood the test of time. It's the same classification that I put forward right at the beginning, more or less, and I haven't had to vary it as a result of new knowledge. We haven't had to change the proposals that we have how to go about repairing these various types of damage. So that's all pretty good news. In the question of what can one do today, I'm afraid I have bad news for you. The fact is, there is essentially nothing we can do. The damage that is created in aging and that eventually causes us to get sick in old age is created by a variety of different inputs, variety of different processes, but the most important of those processes are ones that we can't do anything about. The single most important one is breathing. And, you know, breathing is fairly non-negotiable. You've really got to do it. But if you do it, then you're going to make free radicals in all of your cells, and those free radicals are going to make damage happen. So there's really nothing that we can do. We have to wait until we develop these therapies that will repair that damage. Or, to be more precise, what we have to do is anything we can to hasten the development of those therapies. So the real answer to your question, what can people do today to improve their chances of not suffering from the ill health of old age in due course? The answer is simply hasten the research by, you know, if you've got money, give it to the research, give it to Sense Research Foundation. If you're a journalist, interview me the way you're doing right now. You know, if you're a conference organizer, get me on stage. Advocacy is absolutely vital here. We have to get the word out that this is not science fiction. This is science foreseeable. This is technology that's coming. And the sooner it comes, the more lives we will save.
Well, the pessimist or the skeptic might say, well, then if there's nothing we can do, then who cares? It doesn't matter how I live. I'll smoke and drink and abuse myself, and I'll get into an obese state. I'll never exercise or move, as opposed to everyone in my field that's promoting a lifestyle with nutrigenomics and nutrition and fasting and cleansing and detoxification. You know it all. Does it make any difference then, or is that just quality of life we're talking about?
Well, you've kind of hit the nail on the head there. In today's world, when we don't have these therapies, there is a trade-off between quality and quantity of life, simply because there are things that people enjoy doing that are not good for them. And the reason why your and other people's efforts to get people to live more healthily fall so strongly on deaf ears, why there's only a minority of people who pay attention, is simply because the actual benefit that one gets in terms of quantity of life, or indeed quality of life, from doing things right is relatively small. You might get a couple of extra years of life, and, you know, that sounds like quite a lot. It sounds like it's worth fighting for. But if you're only going to get it by 20 or 30 years of living the way you don't want to live, then the trade-off becomes rather stark. And so I kind of sympathize with people who don't have the willpower to live a healthier life and who do actually shorten their lives by their lifestyle. But of course, what I want to do is get people into a position where they can live exactly how they like and get away with it. It's just that they won't be able to get away with it yet. And I would argue that the best way, perhaps the only way, to get most people to pay attention to the lifestyle message today and to live healthily is to give them the understanding that this might increase their chances of making the cut, of actually surviving healthily long enough to benefit from future therapies that will allow them to live how they like without any health consequences.
I've done a lot of research, Aubrey, on body composition and body typing, like a somatotyping, for example. Looking at you, you look like an ectomorph. Have you always been naturally lean? And do you make a conscious effort with intention to stay lean on purpose?
I have always been lean, and I do not have to make any conscious effort. I always have been able to eat and drink exactly what I like, and nothing happens. So I don't ask people to follow my example lifestyle-wise. I ask people to listen to their body the way that anyone ought to do.
Isn't there evidence that the obese die earlier than the very lean? Like if we look at the centenarians or the blue zone people, like they all tend to be extremely lean and certainly not obese. Does that play a role in any of this?
Sure. I mean, getting seriously obese is definitely bad for you. It's definitely bad for one's glucose tolerance. It's bad for all manner of different aspects of the accumulation of damage. And obese people tend to die younger, as you say. Just like smoking, but it's not new. Everyone knew that already.
Yeah, right. Now, what about nutritional supplements? Do you take any?
Actually, no. Again, I seem to be able to get away with just living on my natural genetic luck. I don't take any nutritional supplements. When my biological age has been measured in various different ways, with lots of different things in my blood being measured and so on, I have always come out a lot younger than my chronological age. So for me, it's a case of if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
And what about your own diet? What kind of foods? Are you omnivorous? Do you make any special effort to avoid certain foods or not?
I am omnivorous.
Yeah, so do you have a special plan? Do you plan meals out in advance? Do you have a strategy? You sort of take it as
No.
It comes? Doesn't matter to you at all?
Correct. Really, you know, I don't live an ideal lifestyle. The main thing that I do wrongly in terms of my long-term health is I don't get enough sleep. But if you think about it, the reason I do all that, the reason I don't pay attention to these things is because I'm focused on hastening the development of these therapies, right? So even from my own personal point of view, I'm probably hastening the defeat of aging by more than the amount that I'm shortening my own life. So it's a net win. But of course, that's not the real reason. The real reason is, as I say, humanitarian. I'm interested in saving a lot of lives. And if that entails a bit of stress and a bit of ill health on my own part, then so be it.
That's very interesting. One of my naturopathic teachers warned me about not sacrificing my own health in helping others get well or in executing the movement through the disposal of myself in the process. but I guess that's a personal choice. I'm fascinated by your motivation and the motivation of all the philosophers and great thinkers throughout the ages. They seem to be compelled by something that's initiated from within, not from the outside. Are you being driven by that same compulsion, some kind of purpose-driven objective that just comes from inside of you?
I guess so, I am. I mean, I've always been very much the kind of person who wants to make a difference in the world. And I don't really know why I want to make a difference, and I don't really care why. I don't care that I don't know why. It doesn't bother me. It's just me.
That's fantastic. I really appreciate your sincerity and genuinity. I can really get that from you, Aubrey. I think there's a lack of people like you out there in the professional field because they will step around issues when you challenge them just by asking them that same question. You just seem so casual and open to be able to answer these questions, which is really refreshing.
Well, thank you.
Now, I'm interested in genetics and nutritional genomics and epigenetics. Do you have any thoughts or feelings on those emerging fields?
Well, I mean, they're big fields. Epigenetics is a field that covers an awful lot of bases, and certainly the epigenetic component of aging is something that we care about. We're interested in understanding the role of random epigenetic change, which is something that's very difficult to study because different cells undergo different changes, even from one cell to the next in the same tissue. And we've actually had a project for some years working on exactly that, looking at the magnitude of that change. So yeah, I mean, it's an exciting area. And of course, the role of nutrition in influencing epigenetic state of tissues is also important. But in general, nutrition will alter things in a regulated way. In other words, all the cells in a given organ will change in the same manner. So it's a gene regulation thing that's already programmed. In that sense, it's not really part of aging.
And your website is sens.org. If we go there, and I'm certainly going to recommend that our students check you out if they haven't already, what will we find there? And is there something available for people with an interest in your field in terms of research or getting involved in what you're doing personally?
Well, yeah. I mean, why would we have a website otherwise? Absolutely. Yes, of course. Yes. Everything in the website talks about what we do and why we do it and, you know, newsworthy developments and so on. Yes, I definitely recommend that you send your students there.
Oh, that's excellent. Well, it's been a half an hour, and thanks so much for your time. I know it's valuable. Thanks so much for being my guest on this edition of SNU, Aubrey.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yes, I'd love for you to inspire us with a final parting comment, if you wouldn't mind, because we will recall what you've said and carry it to a level that maybe might change a few lives.
Inspiring comment. Okay, well, I think what I would say is that I have found it fantastically fulfilling to dedicate my life to making a difference to other people's lives. And I've been extraordinarily privileged to get into a position where I can probably make more difference than any other person on the planet by spearheading the crusade to solve the world's most important problem. So anyone who wants to join me in that crusade will be very welcome. And I assure you that it's always fulfilling for everyone to be involved in this field.
Dr. Aubrey de Grey is a biomedical gerontologist. He's the chief science officer of SENS Research Foundation. Aubrey, we thank you very much for the work you've done, that you're doing, and that you're going to do. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed the topics discussed and our special guest interview on this edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU is produced monthly and is distributed internationally by the Corey Hawley Institute. To learn how you can subscribe to this unique and motivational audio program, please visit CoreyHawley.com.
Represent your lifestyle. New way of life. Listen. It's SNU, sing along, it's true. Yo, coming through straight. Malik with Sports Nutrition Update. Prolong your life. Live long, stay strong, for it won't be long till your time is gone. So I sing this song to pass on wisdom. Hit us up at CoreyHawley.com. Love your life, live right, things will be alright. Knowledge is key, just follow our lead. You'll see a change in heart and health, which leads to wealth and higher self-esteem. Follow your dreams and see. Follow your dreams and see.